In East Asian Buddhism, a common image, of the spiritual life is climbing a mountain. You find that in other spiritual traditions as well. And the point is to get to the top of the mountain. But then, once you get to the top of the mountain, you have to come down. And there's a rare person who just lives on top of the mountain. And, you know, that's kind of an archetype, I guess, a wise person on top of the mountain who dispenses wisdom. The seekers crawl the way up to the top. And beatifically, you're sitting there and kind of just... And life is happy. But very few people live on top of the mountains. They eventually come down. And so in some East Asian art, there's depictions of Shakyamuni Buddha coming down the mountain. So it's not just a matter of going up, but it's also this very important movement of coming back down, walking down the mountain. And in the Zen tradition, they talk about, in a sense, coming down the mountain and then returning to the marketplace with gift-bestowing hands. Isn't that great? Gift-bestowing hands. So this is kind of the way you return. And this idea of withdrawal and return, of climbing the mountain and coming back down, is one that speaks to the idea of spiritual life being both something maybe inward or something that takes you out of society, but also brings you back into it at some point. And that movement can happen in big cycles. It can, you know, you can go away for 10 years and practice in monastery and then come back in some way or other, some form or other. Or it can happen in an instant, where you just take a moment to be mindful of what's happening here before you respond to the situation. But I'd like to suggest that there are three movements that involve this responding to the world, coming down back from the mountain. And there are kind of three ways of understanding this practice that we do. And the first one, to borrow a phrase from Paul Heller, the abbot of Zen Center, he talks about getting close and doing nothing. Get close and do nothing. And what he means by this is be really present, be really attentive to whatever situation you're in. So get close, doesn't have to mean you don't have to crowd people, but be close and be really there to really sense and feel and be present for what's going on. And then do nothing. Now remember, this is the first thing you do. So that's not the last word. You know, just do nothing, you know. But rather, start there. It's another way of talking about mindfulness. Mindfulness can be understood as offering your presence, offering your attention to something, and then initially doing nothing, just to take it in, to let it register, to find out what's there, to learn from it, to see deeply. And for some people, it's a phenomenal training, very challenging training, to get close and to do nothing. Some people would rather not be present. And if they're present, they don't want to get close. And some people, you know, can be close, can be present, can attend to what's going on. But the idea of being doing nothing is a foreign idea. It's a revolting idea. It's a frightening idea. It's a, you know, because we have to engage. We have to do something. We have to fix it. We're responsible. If we don't show that we care by worrying, then how are people going to know that we care if we don't worry properly? Or if, we're uncomfortable and so we try to fix our discomfort by trying to fix the situation. Or we judge, or we criticize, or we greed operates, we want something different. There's a lot of habitual reactions that human beings can have when we encounter almost anything. And a very important part of Buddhist practice is learning not to give in to the habitual reactivity. And so you might still have them, but don't give in to them. Do nothing. Be still. Here's a poem from, or a chant or something from the Northwestern Native American Indian tradition, Native American tradition. Stand still. The trees ahead and the bushes beside you are not lost. Wherever you are is called here, and you must treat it as a powerful stranger, must ask permission to know it and be known. Listen, the forest breathes, it whispers, I have made this place around you. If you leave it, you may come back again saying, "Hear." No two trees are the same to ravens, no two branches the same to wren. If what a tree or a bush does is lost on you, then you are surely lost. Stand still. The forest knows where you are, and you must let it find you. So stand still. You must ask permission to know it, and for it to know you. So be still. To be still, there's a way of being still which is deeply respectful. Certainly some people have the message they're supposed to be silent and not count and kind of recede into the background. And this is not what we mean. But to be still, maybe in the middle of a situation, as if you count, as if you're, you know, you're important in a sense, but be still and ask for permission to know, permission for something to happen. What is it? What's going on here? What's happening? To be still and do nothing. To be attentive, to be close and do nothing. Another way of saying is to be home, to be here. Part of this process of being still and doing nothing involves a process of settling. Because often what the reactivity, the movements of reaction and being for and against things and trying to make something happen and whatever, it keeps us stirred up, keeps the mind stirred up and the heart stirred up. And when the mind and heart are stirred up, we can't really listen or see or understand deeply what is here, what is going on. So part of this process of being still, being close and being still, is to allow a settling to happen, a relaxing to happen, a calming to happen. And then allows us to be more deeply in touch with what is here, who we really are, what's going on. So a story. Once upon a time, there was a young woman who, with her family, left her country and came to Japan. And they lived down the street from a Buddhist monastery. And she would go, she started kind of visiting the monastery and talking to the monks and nuns who were there. And got interested in meditation practice. And was just beginning a practice and felt valuable for her. When it was time for her family to return to her home country, where there was no Buddhists, people didn't know about meditation there. So she went to the abbess of the monastery and said, told her what her story, what her situation was like, and how could she continue her meditation practice or get help with it when she went back to her own country. And the abbess said to her, ask around in your country. Among the people of your religion, spiritual people, the wise people of your town or your country, ask around to find the person who's the best listener. And then go to that person and ask that person to teach you, to mentor you, and how to be a good listener. So that's different than going to that person saying, "Teach me your religion." That's almost a side. It's like, don't learn the religion from that person, but learn a skill, an ability from that person. Learn how to listen deeply. So be still and get close and be still. Get close and listen. And then another story that I'm very fond of, and I often feel apologetic to repeat stories that some of you have heard me repeatedly. But in the folk ways of the world, stories are often repeated. In my son's school, in kindergarten, they would say the same story every day for a week or two to the kids. So in the world of getting close and being still, we're all still in kindergarten. In the Ramayana, the god Rama is going through the forest and he hears a voice, a very faint voice. And he asks his companions to hear that voice in the forest. And nobody hears the voice but him. So he has to get really still and listen really carefully to hear what the voice is saying. And again, this kind of being still, getting close and listening. And the voice is saying his name, Rama, Rama. So he follows the voice to where the voice is coming from. And it's coming out of a big boulder. And he gently puts his hands on the boulder And when he does that, the boulder breaks open and a woman breaks out. And the woman explains that a long time ago she was bewitched and imprisoned in this rock until someone like Rama or Rama came and lovingly put the hands on there, and then she could be free. One of the very touching aspects of this story is that the woman's name is Alaya. And Alaya in Sanskrit means home, like Himalaya means snow home, the home of the snow. And so her name is home. So that's symbolic. So your home, the place of home, the place of deep rest, that who you are, to listen very deeply to if something that's very faint, maybe no one else can hear it but you. Maybe not maybe. No one else can hear it but you. What is it that only you can hear? What is it only you can do that no one else can do for you? What is it only you can hear? And how do you find it? I mean, so much of our life is petrified or, you know, frozen in some way. So how do we get to something? And so this idea of listening deeply and following this very faint voice, and then the loving hands that get placed on something that's hard and solid and frozen or something, without expectation. Rama is not expecting anything, not trying to break anything open, doesn't know it's there. And then something that's called home has a chance to break free, come out. So this idea of then listening deeply or being very attentive can happen both to the outer world, but also to our inner world, to ourselves, to listen very deeply here. And this then leads to the next phase of this, you know, getting ready to come down the mountain. And that is listening very deeply, listening in some way to a response within us. There's being attentive to the situation, being present for a situation, and then there is allowing some deep response to well up from deep inside of ourselves. And I use the word deep because to contrast it to responses or reactions that come from our egotism, our self-centeredness, from our greed or from our hate or from our fear. And often we have to listen or be quiet for a long time to be able to listen to something that's much deeper what's going on. And we often have to do that with other people as well. A man went to a therapist and said he had been living with his wife, who had been married for many, many years, but they had a lot of conflicts and a lot of struggles, and he felt he needed some help. Therapist heard for a while what was going on and said, I think what you need to do is go home. Oh, I said, have you ever tried listening to your wife? And he said, no. So I think you should go home and try to listen to your wife. So he does that, and he comes back sometime later and said, you know, I've listened to my wife. It didn't really help. And then the therapist says, oh, you need to go back again and now listen to what's behind the words. What's behind the words? What else, you know, is between the words? And so what is that listening like? What else, you know? So being still and waiting, being still and being attentive, is allowing for some deeper response to happen. Something that's not our first thought, our first reaction and all that. And there's innumerable times where in my capacity of an infinitely wise person, I'm talking to someone, and they tell me something about, you know, themselves, and it's obvious to me, you know, completely obvious what they should do and what I should tell them, and perhaps a little glimmer of real wisdom kind of breaks through, and for whatever reason I don't tell them right away, and then we have a conversation, maybe I ask questions or just give space to this person to keep talking or something, and then because of that space, because of that time that's given, something new is born that is very different than what I thought should happen or what I thought should be. Some new understanding, some new deeper insight or something happens that neither one of us in the conversation maybe could have anticipated beforehand. But because of making the space and the time, not rushing to a solution, allowed something deeper to happen. So it could be as simple as taking, you know, pausing one moment in a conversation and seeing what will arise. Give something a chance to arise. Or it can mean spending a year or 2 years thinking about some important decision, waiting, not making a decision. In the early 1980s, when I was living at the Zen monastery called Tassajara, I was in my 20s and wondering what to do with my life in many big ways. And I spent a year and a half of my time at Tassajara doing this process of being still, listening, reflecting. And then as responses started coming up, reactions, responses coming up, what to do with my life, testing it, questioning it, listening behind those responses, exploring them, and just letting it all be for about a year and a half until some clarity arose about what my life was going to be about. So, and I've known people who've gone on retreats for, you know, a week or 3 months or for, you know, even much longer in order to find themselves, in order to find how they want to respond to the world, how they want to live their life, because it wasn't clear. Not only people in their 20s have known people do that, but I've known people in their 40s and 60s who have stepped out, in a sense, in order to be able to do that deep being still and listening to some deeper response about what wants to come out of them. And I've also known people who have spent 30, 40 years not listening to their deep responses. I've known people who have had very clear, very deep yearnings for a spiritual life in their 20s, for example. And then for some reason or other, the responsibilities of family and jobs and all kinds of stuff, putting it aside, and having had this yearning almost fester. And then finally, at some point in their 50s or 60s, and it's almost like I've seen something almost like the boil is about to break. And the people I've known who I felt pretty convinced that if they continue the life they were living, they were going to die. Because it was that powerful, the sense of not being in touch with themselves. And they had to do a radical kind of transformation, kind of dropping out of their life in order to listen to this very deep yearning they had that had been kind of put aside or repressed for so many years. So to give ourselves a chance to hear what's here in a very deep way, and to listen and to find kind of deep inside, what is our response? And some of this comes from not knowing. You know, this being still, getting close and being still, being close and doing nothing, is also kind of not, it's partly taking the stance, I don't know. I don't know what's here. I don't know what should be. And so in that not knowing space, maybe allowing something new to happen. I was partly inspired to give this talk by meeting with some chaplains in training on Friday. And one of the chaplains in training said that he came into a room in a hospital with an elderly woman who I think was quite sick, maybe, you know, in danger of dying. And she started telling the chaplain that a few months ago her husband had died, and that she'd met her husband when she was 16 and married him soon thereafter. And that her husband was the first person that she'd ever kissed romantically. And the only person in all those years. And now he died some months earlier, and now she was very sick. And there was maybe a little more to the story. But in listening to the story, that this chaplain in training started crying. And wondering, what should I do? How should I help this person? What should I say? You know, kind of confused. But so moved by this, he started crying. After a while, she said to him, "Oh, thank you so much. I feel so supported because I feel you understand me." So, you know, he didn't know. He had all ideas. He's supposed to be a chaplain. He's supposed to know what to do and do something wise. But he didn't know. But in that not knowing, his response, his deep response, was through empathy, was to cry with her. And that perhaps was the best response she could have gotten. So what allows us to have that kind of response? Another one of these chaplains in training on Friday had spent many years living in a Buddhist retreat center, doing very intensive Buddhist practice, and somewhat isolated practice, kind of alone. And in the last year had felt that her compassion for others was getting dry. And what brought her to this long retreat was her sense of strong compassion for the world, and this is her response to it. But as her sense of compassion for others had gone dry, the motivation for doing the practice had dried up certain way. And she felt what she needed to do was to refresh or re-enliven or invigorate the life of her compassionate vow or compassionate response to the world. So she left the retreat center and is now being trained to be a chaplain, thinking that somehow responding to people, meeting people who are actually in conditions of suffering, would somehow touch her heart and reawaken this very, very deep, heartfelt way in which she wants to live in response to the world. For me, when we can get still, or the equivalent of that, and discover what our deepest response, deepest intentions are, I think that's not coming from our ego or unwholesome states of mind. I think that the response is really beautiful. It's one of the really beautiful things of a human life. Not just simply that we have the capacity to be awake and to be free. To be awake is to get close and do nothing. But to also have a response to the world, to meet the world, to step forward into the world, to come down the mountain, I think is really beautiful. So we listen deeply to hear a response. It can be, come relatively quick in some situations. It might take a really long time to discover what that is in other situations. It has to do with our response to others. It has to do with our, response to ourselves, in all area. And then we come to the third phase of coming down the mountain. And that is the enactment of that response, the acting on that response. And the acting of the response is, is the details of how you do it, the details of how you engage in the world with it. And that is takes a lot of skill, takes a lot of understanding often. Because you might have a response, like a big one, like I want to be like to be compassionately respond to the suffering of the world, and I want to go off and become a Buddhist monk. What I really need to do is go off and sit a long, long retreat of 10 years, and really kind of discover some tremendous font of wisdom and enlightenment and awakening and freedom inside of me, so that I could really go back and be helpful to the whole world. So that's what I'm going to do. Regardless of the fact that I have 13 kids at home and they have no means of supporting themselves, and they just have to take care of themselves, and I'll just go off and save the world. That's not enacting the response given the conditions we find ourselves in. It's kind of ignoring it. So everyone is in a particular condition. We have our own personal condition, our own particular background, our family, cultural, ethnic background, the personal experience of background, given who we are. We have the particular circumstances we find ourselves in. Beth Goldring somehow found ourselves in Cambodia, and so her response is particular to Cambodia and her situation there. Some people are here, living lives of family. Some people don't have family. Some people have all kinds of situations. Or the response has to do, the details have to do with the particular people we're encountering and meeting. Do we really understand and know who it is that we're trying to help or respond to? What's appropriate and what's not appropriate? So the enactment part requires us using our intelligence to the best of our ability. Not assume that we have some natural, intuitive, kind of wise, kind of bubbling up that just knows what to do easily and effortlessly, and it's just going to be so nice. The response, the deep sense of response, might be effortless. I hope it's effortless. I hope it feels natural or, whole, complete or something. But then how to live that response is one that requires our intelligence and our care and our sensitivity to others and to ourselves and to the situation, and discover what the appropriate response is. Famous Zen story of an old Zen monk. He'd been a Zen teacher, been a Zen monk for decades and decades, and been a teacher for many years, and a young whippersnapper comes to a monk, comes along and says, basically says, to all these years of Zen practice and teaching, what is your teaching of a lifetime? What's the core teaching that you have? In a summary, can you give me a kernel? And so the Zen master says, an appropriate response. So it all boils down to an appropriate response. And behind that appropriate response, I hope, is a sense of getting close and doing nothing, being able to listen deeply for a deep response, and then being able to enact that response in the appropriate way, given causes and conditions. And perhaps a great master is not someone who has woken up. A great master is not someone who has some deep, heartfelt response. A great master is someone who has come to the stage where they have the ability to respond appropriately in different situations. Some people say, it's relatively easy to wake up. What's hard is coming down the mountain. So I think of those two as being inseparable, going up and coming down. And that it's not just a matter of retiring to some paradise of bliss and peace, but it's also a matter of responding to this world that we live in. And the world we live in needs people to respond. It needs it. My favorite God story, I think, theistic story. Some person dies and goes up, to the heaven, and sees God and starts complaining. And seems reasonable to me. If there is a God, and says, you should see the mess down there. Just, you should see what people are doing to each other, and it just seems like it's getting worse and worse, and you should do something. And God looks at this person and says, I did do something. I made you. So the world needs us to respond. We don't look elsewhere for the response. Don't assign responsibility elsewhere. I think it's, here in this place, here in this forest, be still, listen. And here in this corner of the world, it's up to you to respond. So, that's my thoughts for today. We have some time if anybody has any questions you'd like to ask or comments or stories of your own. Yeah, right behind you, Linda.
Thank you. I've recently come up against both East Indian and some of my other teachers in other centers, and it seems to be rampant more in the West about the end goal being happiness or bliss. And so I would appreciate a comment because my other teachers don't see it that way.
What was the last part?
My other teachers do not see it that way.
So you're saying some teachers say the end goal is happiness and bliss,
yeah,
and other teachers don't see it that way.
Yeah.
And the other teachers see, what's the goal? What's the end goal?
I'm still grasping, but more like just awareness.
Just being aware.
Yeah.
And then some teachers, the third type, say just awareness and bliss are the same thing.
Yes. Yes, but it seems in some of the translations and the writings that there's a very real difference in that type of, maybe it's just my conditioned reaction to bliss or happiness is like being the end, and that's not the end, it's beyond.
Great. So given the kind of talk I just gave today, if I, instead of give an answer to you, the right answer, set you straight. If you had to answer that question for yourself, if you were to do that kind of deep listening, that what resources, what ability, what place would you go inside of yourself to find the answer to your concern?
today is more an awareness of removing levels of conditioning. I'm not so, I get preoccupied with that. So maybe I don't stay quiet, close, long enough, I don't know.
So the answer is, for today, in this particular situation, what's important for you is somehow removing the layers of conditioning that keep you from being able to be still or be close. Is that what you said?
Yes, or just seeing that they're inhibiting my awareness. They're giving the false answer, like your talk would say. You know, I've got the first answer, yeah, and so I'll do the reaction. Yeah.
So I loved your answer, because it was particular to this situation and where you are today. And rather than getting kind of blinded by some mountain peak, you're just actually saying, this is what's happening here today, and this is what my path is, this is what's needed right now for me. And then if you do that work that seems very, very profound, then at some point on the other side of those obstacles, something else would show itself. So I think that to me is very respectful of where you're at. And then you'll maybe at some point find out for yourself the answer to that bigger question you asked, the tension you feel between different teachers. Or it could be that they're all right. In their own situation. Their appropriate responses in different situations. In the Zen tradition, in Buddhism, we often have this teaching about not-self, which in a kind of simplistic and often misunderstood way, people say it means no self, there is no self. In the Zen tradition, they'll say that you'll only discover who you are in your response. So you don't know who you are until you act in the world. So if you just sit quietly and kind of like reflect, and think, who am I really? The Zen people, you won't find that way. You won't find a thing that who you are. But if someone comes along and is thirsty, you are the person who offers them water. You find out in that situation who you are. So you discover who you are in the response. So for you, you discover your answer to your question or your answer and where you're at right now. And to me, that's quite significant.
I have a question related to you. I read in books about making choices that are for long-term good as versus short-term. And this is sort of a complicated question. In terms of that. Responding correctly, my question is about kind of the gap between what you know or you think you know about the correct response and habitual conditioning. For instance, I read Buddhist texts and meditate and consider myself a person who tries to be mindful and present or compassionate or kind, but then a lot of my life is filled with sort of knee-jerk reactions that have been there a long time. Now, I'm very different than maybe I was 10 years ago in terms of changing that. But there seems like this gap that's almost sometimes impenetrable between what you think you know, what response you think is the response, and what you sort of compulsively go to each time.
You're saying that sometimes the compulsive response overrides whatever wiser understanding you seem to have.
Right. You fall into distraction or judgment or something that you know that you are not.
Yeah, it's true. It can be that way, often, for many of us. And so that's why we call it a practice. We practice. and there's a variety of things in practice that can help. Certainly it helps to... The calmer you can get, the more likely you are to respond from your wisdom rather than your reactivity. If you're stressed and harried, you're more likely to respond from your reactivity. Cultivating habits, good habits, like a good habit of pausing, even just having an inner, no one else might notice, but you have an inner pause. So that you can kind of check out what's going on a little bit is often helpful. Developing a habit of being in your body, knowing what's going on with your body, is a great support for this process of noticing when you're reactive and when you're not. And another thing that can be very helpful is to use a dramatic word, is confession. Or putting everything on the table. So if you have a certain habit of reacting in an unwholesome way, rather than keeping it private, make it relatively public, in the sense of saying, you know, I have this difficulty. Let me tell you. So tell someone. Tell the person, there I did it again. I apologize. Sometimes you can make certain kind of inner difficulties or shortcomings public in a free way, in an easy way, in the appropriate times and places, to the appropriate people. It can sometimes take the sting out of it, or it can take the, you kind of feel you're in a bigger accountable, you're accountable, it's more shared. It makes it more conscious, more acknowledged, so that it's less likely to catch you. If you're always trying to keep it, your unwholesome things private, so no one can know, there's a way in which that also kind of keeps it from yourself. Sometimes, making it public to the right people. Not everyone. Don't go. Okay, last one.
This is not really a question, but I wanted to share a wonderful experience I had yesterday up at Spirit Rock. It was a Mindfulness for Educators workshop given by Diana Winston and some other teachers. And a particularly moving experience was to see a video put on by a group called Inner Kids, and it's down in Los Angeles public schools. So we got to see some kindergarten kids learning how to pay attention to their breathing. They were lying down on the floor, and there were these little Beanie Baby teddy bears on their bellies, so they were learning soft belly breathing, and they were learning about breathing by blowing into pinwheels and looking at it looked like a chart with three colored areas, and they could move this blinking magnet around to say where were their bodies, were their bodies relaxed or excited, were their minds relaxed or excited, or something in between. And it was very moving. Because it was done in public schools, it was very secular. There's no mention of Buddhism. But it was called the new ABCs, which A is for attention, B is for balance, and C is for compassion or clarity. And it was very moving to see how this is happening down in L.A.
Beautiful. So nice to hear this. And so I have a few things to say in response to that. against my better judgment. No, I think hopefully it's wise. That's the intention. I've checked it out already. But one of them can seem very self-serving. Can seem that way. But that's not the intention. It's a wonderful way in which things come back and go in circles, and good things often come back and bring happiness in ways. So I feel very happy listening to that. And it was my idea to have that day at Spirit Rock. I was the one who set it up. And so just, I arranged for it. And so then, I didn't go. But then I get it back. Isn't it beautiful? I felt really happy to hear this, And I kind of assumed I'd never hear about it again. But then it was great, so thank you. And the other thing is, are you a teacher? Anyway, I think teachers are some of the great heroes in our society. I think teachers are just the best. So thank you.